From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Diagramming sentences has become a lost art, but Kitty Burns-Flory is trying to revive it with her new book, Sister Bernadette's Barking Dog, a celebration of this once popular approach to learning grammar and improving English. It's her 10th book, and it's from Melville House Publishing. And I'm very pleased that it has brought Kitty Burns-Flory to my show now. Hi.
Hi. Nice to be here, Leonard.
For those who don't remember or have never learned, how would you describe the process of diagramming a sentence?
Well, I can describe how to diagram a very simple sentence on the radio. Once you get beyond that, you really have to have a blackboard or a piece of paper. But it's essentially drawing a picture of the sentence by putting it on a line. And it starts with a straight line. And if you take the sentence, the dog barked, which is my perennial example in the book, dog is on the left of the straight line, barked is on the right side, and the line is bisected with a short line that goes through it. Dog is then the subject of the sentence. Barked is the predicate, you know, they're the noun and the verb. And then the, or whatever other modifier you might have for the dog, the brown dog, the large dog, goes on a slanted line under dog. And that's about as simple as a sentence can get.
And what is it, what is the goal of doing this, the aim of doing this?
Well, the goal is to show you in a diagram what the parts of speech are and what they do in a sentence. It's pretty obvious from the dog barked, you know, there's really not much mystery to what that sentence is about. But once it gets complicated, the diagram can show you things that are not necessarily clear just from looking at the sentence on paper.
How is this different from parsing a sentence?
I don't know a lot about parsing, but I do know that parsing doesn't involve going up to the blackboard and drawing something. Parsing is just about calling out. You know, the teacher will say the dog barked, and you'll call out dog, noun, bark, mm-hmm. verb. And, of course, again, it gets more complicated than that.
And I'd imagine with a sentence from Joseph Conrad or from... Well, you have Henry James in
Henry
here.
James was
William
a great
Faulkner,
one.
Who wrote page-long sentences.
Yes.
This could be absolutely crazy-making. Was it, in fact, Sister Bernadette who taught you to diagram?
Yes. We started in the sixth grade at my school, and she was our sixth grade teacher.
Well, we had to do sentence diagrams when I attended PS16 in the Dark Ages, but I think I daydreamed my way through those mm-hmm. lessons. Do you think it survived longer in parochial schools?
Yes, it definitely did. I've had emails since the book came out. I've had emails from plenty of people who are still fairly young and who had diagramming in the 70s and the 80s.
And what do you think that is? Had philosophies of teaching changed in the public schools and the parochial schools?
That could be. I'm not a teacher, so I'm not really sure why. But I think that maybe traditional methods hang on longer in Catholic schools, which tend to be more, you know, technically traditional than public schools.
And why do you think the practice has fallen out of favor?
Well, from what I've been told, and this is, again, by talking to teachers, it declined drastically in the 60s when it was not considered to be a good way to teach, to do such systematized, rote, you know, methods, but to have kids be much more self-expressive and get into, you know, why you're doing something and why you're feeling about it the way you are rather than things like diagramming.
And what do you think has been gained and what do you think has been lost?
Well, I certainly think something has been gained having gone through Catholic schools in the 50s where, you know, if we had presumed to try to express ourselves, we would have had our knuckles wrapped. And so I think that and, of course, I do have to say that I think something has been lost only because, again, I talk to people and I work with young people and I can see that in a lot of cases they're not writing really good English. Not that everybody that I went to school with was either, but we were taught grammar and the diagramming was a reinforcement of that. And from what I hear now, talking to teachers, grammar sometimes just isn't being taught at all, whether with diagramming or with anything. It's just overlooked.
You're a copy editor. So have you ever come across a sentence where you thought, gee, if this author could just diagram a sentence, this sentence never would have been created?
I have often thought that that would be one way to explain it with a diagram. But, you know, usually anything but beyond the dog barked, it's so complicated that if you haven't started out, you know, with a Sister Bernadette when you were 12 years old, then it's pointless.
You trace the practice to a book written in 1860. What was its title?
The book that I traced it back to originally was actually published in 1877, and it was a spinoff from a book from 1860. The one that really popularized diagramming came out in 1877. I think that was the first edition, from what I could tell. And it was written by two Brooklyn men, Alonzo Reed and Brainerd Kellogg. They taught at the Brooklyn Polytechnic Institute, which is now called Polytechnic University, a well-known Brooklyn school. It was a brilliant idea that they had. They tried it out on their students. They tried it out on faculty. They published it, and it took off, like, as I said in the book, like a measles epidemic through the schools. Everybody was doing it, and they became very rich.
The book that I was thinking of had one of the longest titles in the history of the world, and I was wondering whether it would have been Hell to Diagram. There was a man named S.W. Clark, mm-hmm. and he became interested in teaching language this way.
Right. He did the first pictures of, from what I could, in my research, from what I could tell, he did the first pictures of language. His book did come out in the 1860s, and he used a system of balloons that were attached together, very hard to describe on the radio, but as I said in the book, they look a lot like those balloon animals that they at least used to make at kids' birthday parties. And, you know, they make a dachshund by tying off the balloon in different, these wacky looking things, and each little balloon thing would have a word in it, and you could see how they related to each other, at least theoretically. In practice, the things are so crazy looking that they just make you laugh.
You say that the book wasn't confined to grammar, but taught some general information as well. What kinds of observations were offered?
Well, they would use science, you know, facts about science, facts about animals. You know, the ostrich is the fastest running bird, or you know, the main export of Paraguay is bananas or something. You know, it was a chance, I think, to improve you in terms of the little trivia that you knew, as well as
teach somebody while you're teaching somebody.
Yeah, that's something. Right, killing two birds.
You've analyzed the sentences selected for diagramming to reveal something of the time in which the book was written. What were the sentences like, and what did you infer from them?
Well, the Reed and Kellogg were, they had a grim side as well as a lighthearted side, and they had sentences that, as I said in the book, my personal favorite is an Arab proverb, which is, "Death is the black camel which stands at every man's gate."
And well, that's a nice thing to get
yeah,
to
lovely
kids
for, you know, 11-year-olds, too. And "All Men Must Die" was another one, which is quite easy to diagram, at least. The black camel one is not. One of my favorites is "Little Arthur Was Murdered." I have no idea where that came from, but that, you know, that's in there.
How nice. Are there sentences that defy diagramming?
Yes.
Or can diagramming ever make the meaning murkier?
Well, those are two questions. And the first one, most sentences can be diagrammed, and as I point out in the book, even incorrect sentences can be diagrammed. Unless you know they're incorrect, they look just fine when they get put on their lines. But I have a fairly extensive discussion of Gertrude Stein in the book. I'm not a Gertrude Stein expert, but I quickly became a devoted amateur when I started reading her. She had very definite ideas about writing, about parts of speech, about grammar, and she loved diagramming. But and she talks about that quite a lot, about how diagramming was the most exciting thing she had ever done in school.
And since she was a real influence on Hemingway, mm-hmm. I don't know whether Hemingway also diagrammed.
He must have.
Everybody did.
He went to the public schools in Illinois.
You say that you can actually still get copies of the books from the 19th century, I guess later editions, mm-hmm. at eBay.
Mm-hmm.
Is
I
that
was thrilled.
Where you got yours?
I was thrilled to get a copy. Yeah, a very nice copy.
What kind of shape were they in?
Really good condition. But somebody had done a rubbing of an old dime in the back, a dime from the 20s, and so that was fun too. But aside from that, it was not marked up at all. Maybe it hadn't been used that much. I don't know.
Didn't Noam Chomsky point out that nonsense can be perfectly grammatical?
Yes, exactly. exactly. And he's absolutely right. A sentence doesn't have to mean a thing as long as it's diagrammable. And his famous, it is, I didn't realize it was famous until, again, I started doing research. His famous sentence is colorless green ideas sleep furiously. There are five parts of speech there. They don't make much sense at all, and yet they make a coherent sentence, and you can put them on the little lines.
So that might also suggest that Bushisms are diagrammable.
Well, yes, and I did include one or two of those delightful sentences in the book. Yes, you can, as I said, you can diagram anything, and it doesn't tell you anything about the sentence except that it is on a diagram. It can be incorrect, it can be crazy, but, you know, there it is.
One of the Henry James sentences that you diagrammed in your book cannot be contained on a single page. Is that good or bad?
It was good for Henry James.
But
it worked for him.
But it would also suggest that teachers could go crazy trying to prove this point, or at a certain point,
yes,
you have to drop this when you're dealing with writers like James or Proust.
That's right. Any teacher who tried to teach diagramming via Henry James would have to be nuts. You know, it's a losing battle. His sentences are so complicated.
Does diagramming help you recognize style?
I think only in the sense that you can see, if you try to diagram one of these writers, if you try to diagram James or Faulkner or Proust, you know, Proust, of course, would never have had diagramming because it was a purely American invention, but we thought it would be fun to diagram a Proust sentence. You can see exactly what they've done with the language. It's amazing what you can do with the English language.
And I would say the same of Hemingway. The diagrams of his sentences can't be confused with any of the other authors that
That's right.
You're, as I said earlier, you're a copy editor, and you say there was perhaps only one famous copy editor.
Mm-hmm.
Who was she?
That was Eleanor Gould. I'm blanking on her last name.
From the New Yorker.
From the New Yorker, yes. Eleanor Gould Packard. She was a copy editor at the New York for 55 years, and she really did a great deal to mold the style of that magazine, of hypercorrectness.
And is hypercorrectness good, do you think? You're a copy editor, do you?
Sure, I think it's good. I'm a copy editor. I think it almost always is, unless you're dealing with a real artist who knows how to use the language in the way that he or she finds effective. Mostly, I really think it's better to be hypercorrect.
But it can also lead to a certain kind of blandness of language. And there were New Yorker writers who complained that sometimes she just took all the life out of the sentence.
Yes, that's right. And of course, a really good copy editor would never do that, would allow for idiosyncrasies. But you still have to have the nouns and verbs agreeing. You know, you can't have dangling modifiers, et cetera.
Can you remember that sentence E.B. White wrote that you quote that ends with five prepositions?
I love that so much. He gives that example as a little boy is going upstairs to bed, and he wants his father to read him a book. So his father brings the book up, and the little boy says, "What did you bring that book that I don't want to be read to out of up for?"
Of course, Miss Packard would have.
She would not have liked that at all, no.
You say there are two schools of thought about what you call the English language biz. The prescriptivists,
yes,
and the descriptivists.
Yes.
And they are?
Well, this is an old controversy. It goes back hundreds of years, and it never dies. It's always there. The descriptivists believe that however people talk is the way the English language is. That's the English language. If you say me and him went to the movies, it's just as good as saying he and I went to the movies. What is the point of getting those two pronouns in the proper case as long as everybody understands what you mean? And that would be a very extreme version of the descriptivist side, but that's basically what they say. Whereas the prescriptivists believe that there's a right way and a wrong way, and that the right way is not just better, but that the wrong way shouldn't exist at all.
But the right way isn't, sometimes was the wrong way just 10 years ago.
That's right. That's right.
The so language, how do we deal with that?
Well, prescriptivists don't deal with it all that much. Descriptivists, of course, think, yeah, man, whatever. And the language, by its nature, it grows and it changes, and it always has and it always will. And there's no way you can hold it back.
For example, split infinitives. Sometimes,
yes,
avoiding a split infinitive makes for really clumsy sentences.
That's right. And the only reason not to split an infinitive, and it's really not a very good reason, is that there was a time when people were trying to model the English language on Latin, and in Latin you can't split an infinitive because an infinitive is only one word.
What are the three errors that everyone still freaks out about?
Well, I have a section in my book where I take, kind of at random, because there are probably more errors than that, but my three favorites are, first of all, ain't. ain't is still something that nobody is ever, ever, ever allowed to say. It's just considered very, very low class and hyper incorrect.
Even in spoken English? Because we do have different rules for written and spoken English.
Yes, but I think that with a lot of people, certainly not everyone, there are certainly many, many dialects where ain't is perfectly acceptable, but anybody who has any interest in language would certainly say that ain't is wrong. And I think parents just routinely correct their kids, you know, if they hear them say ain't. Don't say ain't. Don't say ain't. That's probably...
And take your elbows off the table.
Right. It's right up there with that one. And yet ain't is a sincere attempt to give the English language something that it ain't got, which is a contraction for I am not. There's no way to say it. You can't say I amn't.
And ain't used to be acceptable especially in Britain, among
right.
the upper classes.
That's right, yeah.
So that's one.
That's one. The other one is another attempt to improve the language. There is no second person plural pronoun in English, so that you can say, I went, you went, he, she, or it went, we went. And again, it's you went. Is that you, a bunch of people, or one person? And then they went is, of course, the last one. But a lot of people say yous, or they say you all, or they say y'all, or they say you guys, or they say something. And of all those things, I think yous is really very, very frowned upon.
But the reason is that there was a time when you was only plural, and there was, what was it, thou or something?
The. I guess, yeah.
So
of course, very
we just confused everything with, because people were speaking incorrectly a long time ago, we got rid of the thee and the thou.
Yeah, these things happen to English, and it's left with these funny little, I think English must be very hard to learn for a non-speaker. We're left with these funny little anomalies, and that's one of the big ones.
And the third?
And then the third one is the double negative. You know, you got no class if you talk like that. And a double negative is perfectly fine in French, for example, where, you know, je ne sais pas, you have the ne and the pas, and they add up to a negative. But in English, it is considered very bad to do that. And again, you know, there are things to be said for it and things to be said against it.
I'll try not to make those mistakes in the
it's
future.
It's probably better not to.
I want to thank you so much for being with us. Kitty Burns-Flory's charming book, Sister Bernadette's Barking Dog, is published by Melville House Publishing. It is. It follows 9 novels, many short stories and essays, and this is the one that I think all of the people who love the English language segments on our show will want to look into. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Leonard.
Up next, the stories of 9 exceptional men who fled anti-Semitism in Hungary during the lead-up to World War II. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.